Well, you might like to turn to the passage we read from Acts chapter 17. A couple of years ago, the writer Peter Hitchens was in Australia. Peter Hitchens is the brother of Christopher Hitchens, who is, along with Richard Dawkins, one of the leading outspoken kind of fundamentalist atheists. And Peter Hitchens is his brother. And Peter Hitchens is actually a Christian. And Peter was out in Australia for an annual event called the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. I think it happens every year. And he appeared on the Q&A program with Tony Jones. And he was asked on that program, you may have seen it, you can still see it on YouTube, I think. He was asked right at the very end of the program, what is the most dangerous idea in the world? And he said, it's the resurrection of Jesus. If you saw the program, it's well worth trying to find it on YouTube. The audience just didn't know how to react to that. They didn't know whether to clap or jeer. They didn't know quite what he meant by that. Until he explained. Well, something like that happened to Paul in Athens. In this passage that we're going to look at this morning. Look what we're told here in verse 21. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. That's how it was in Athens. And we're told when Paul came preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection, they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears. And we'd love to know what they mean. And when they heard about the resurrection of the dead, it says there in verse 32, they didn't know whether to clap or jeer. Some of them sneered. Others said, we'd like to hear you again on this subject. It was a festival of dangerous ideas. Why is the resurrection of Jesus such a dangerous idea? It was dangerous personally for the Apostle Paul on this occasion. Let me just set the scene for you. Just come with me to Mars Hill in Athens. You can still go there. That's where this festival of dangerous ideas took place. Now, I used to think that Mars Hill was a little bit like Speaker's Corner in London. You know, a place where you could go and just do open air speaking and preaching. But it's more like Mars Hill in Athens is more like a kind of parliamentary select committee than it is an open air venue. The Areopagites were the gatekeepers. They were the guardians of the city's religion and morals and education. 450 years before, Socrates was hauled before the Areopagus and was accused of corrupting the youth of the city with dangerous ideas. And it cost him his life. So this is going to be a tough assignment, isn't it? It's going to be a tough gig for Paul. It's not just standing up to preach in the open air. That's scary enough. But he's going to have to mount a defense for the faith. He's going to have to mount a defense of Christianity before the most intimidating bunch of people in the ancient world. This is much scarier than appearing on Q&A. Surveys have shown that the average Australian is more afraid of public speaking than dying. I suppose it is a bit like dying. You die 1,000 deaths if you stand up in public. Imagine having to speak without notice to the joint faculties of Oxford and Cambridge, or to a combined sitting of the Australian Parliament. The thought is terrifying, isn't it? It's enough to bring you out in a cold sweat. Paul's heart must have been racing. Well, we know that it was, because Dr. Luke tells us. Look at verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed, and that's a medical term. It's the word paroxysm, I think. It's a medical term for a fit or a seizure. Remember, Dr. Luke, he's writing this. He's a doctor. When Paul saw this city full of idols, he nearly has a heart attack. His heart is racing, not just because he's nervous. Of course he's nervous. He's nervous of speaking before such an august company. Of course he is. But that's not why his heart is racing. It's not a fit of rage. The word that's used here in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, it's the same word. It's the same word that's used to describe how God feels when Moses comes down from the mountain and they've built a golden calf. It's the same word that's used to describe God's heart towards his people when they are guilty of idolatry. It's the same word. That's how Paul feels as he comes to the city of Athens. As he walks around and sees this city full of idols, it breaks his heart. He's not a tourist looking at the sights. He's an ambassador of Christ. And as he comes to this city that is renowned for its philosophers and its civilization, his heart is breaking. What does he see? Well, he sees a city full of idols. That's what we're told there in verse 16. A city swamped with idols, submerged in idols. Just imagine it if you can. In Athens, there were more gods than people, we're told. There were 30,000 gods in a population of 10,000 people. So on every street corner, there was a temple or a shrine or a statue. It was Heinz's 57 varieties. Pick and mix. All options covered. And just to make sure that you hadn't actually offended some god that you didn't know about by leaving him off the list, there was even a shrine to the unknown god, just in case. It was a pluralistic, multi-faith society. Not very different to ours. Just before he died, Spike Milligan was asked, "Do you pray?" Remember Spike Milligan, the goon? The goons? Remember the goons? Spike Milligan was a very gifted comedian. Just before he died, he was asked, "Do you pray?" He said, "Yes, I do, all the time. But I don't know who I'm praying to." That's how it was in Athens. That's how it is in Australia today, isn't it? People pray. People believe in God, if you believe the surveys. Loads of people believe in God. Loads of people go to church at Easter. But they don't know who they're praying to. People are spiritual. People like to describe themselves in that way in Australia today. People are spiritual, like David Beckham. When one of his kids was born, he told the press, "I have a sense of spirituality. I want Brooklyn christened. But I don't know into what religion yet." Christened? Thought that would have given the show away. That's Athens. A city swamped with idols. And it was a city swarming with ideas. Look at verse 18. We're told that some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers argued with him. Some said to him, "What is this pseudo-intellectual trying to say, this babbler?" Others replied, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign deities, because he was telling the good news about Jesus and the resurrection." It was not only was it a city swamped with idols, it was a city swarming with ideas, full of philosophers. Athens is famous, of course, for its philosophers. Chuck Swindoll once described philosophers as people who talk about things that they don't understand, but they make it sound as if it's your fault that they don't understand. Well, there are lots of people like that in Athens. Not only in the university, but on the streets and in the marketplace. Because everybody's a philosopher. Anyone with an opinion about anything is a philosopher. People who start an argument in the pub. People who write to the newspapers. Everyone's a philosopher. But of course, in Athens, there was some heavyweight philosophy. The Epicureans and the Stoics, they held very different schools of thought, very different worldviews. Prince Philip is a Stoic, as are probably most members, senior members of the royal family. You know, stiff upper lip, do your duty. That's the Stoic worldview. The Epicureans were hedonists. They lived for pleasure, not duty. I guess most Australians are hedonists, really. Make the most of it. She'll be right. Eat, drink, and be merry. It's the lucky country. Tomorrow we die, so let's make the most of it right now. That's the Epicurean philosophy. And Paul saw all this, he heard all this, as he wandered around the city waiting for his friends to arrive. He discovered a city swamped with idols and swarming with ideas. Shrines and temples in every street corner, competing worldviews in the marketplace, heated debate and controversy in the public square. Neil Postman, who's a non-Christian sociologist, wrote a very insightful little book analyzing Western culture. It's called Amusing Ourselves to Death. That's what they were doing in Athens. Theirs was a culture in decline, just as ours is. They were more interested in what is new than in what is true. That's what it says, isn't it? Verse 21, they spent their time on nothing else but telling or hearing something new. That is a symptom of a culture that is in decline. Now, how do you reach a city like that? How do you reach a society like ours? A pluralistic, multi-faith society. How does Paul reach Athens? Well, notice what he does. There's a negative and a positive. First thing he does is this. He analyzes the culture. Do you see that there in verse 22? So Paul, we're told, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, listen to the verbs here because it's important. I perceive in every way that you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, it depends which translation you've got, you might just have I see, but the word that in the Greek there for see is the word from which we get our word to theorize, theory. So he's not just window shopping. He's not just wandering around idly, glancing at things, filling in his time. He's actually reflecting on what he's looking at. He's thinking deeply about what he sees. He's reading the culture. So that when he comes to speak to them, as we'll see in a moment, he connects with them, doesn't he? He's not interested in the aesthetics. He's not interested in the architecture. He's not interested in the art. He sees beneath all that, and he analyzes it in order to address it. And that's what we've got to do if we're going to reach Australians today. The Christian philosopher Francis Schaeffer once wrote this. He said, people often say to me, what would you do if you met a really modern man on a train and you had just an hour to talk to him about the gospel? What would you do? This is what he said. I would spend 45 or 50 minutes on the negative to show him his real dilemma, to show him that he is more dead than even he thinks he is. Then I would take 10 or 15 minutes to tell him the gospel. Unless he understands what is wrong, he will never be ready to listen to and understand the positive. That's what Paul does. That's what we have to do if we want to speak to our generation about Jesus. Paul wants to tell them about Jesus, but he can't. He can't tell them about Jesus without first of all talking about God and showing them why they need Jesus, do you see? And that's what he does. Just look at it. Just glance at it with me. Look what he says. He makes three great big points about God, doesn't he? In verse 24, he says, look, God made you. You didn't make God. That's a good point to make to people who are making idols, making gods out of plaster and silver and gold and putting them on little shrines. What do you think you're doing, Paul says? You shouldn't be thinking of God like that. Imagine that, going into Oxford or Cambridge. That's what the equivalent to talking to the leading philosophers of the day and say, hey, you really shouldn't be thinking of God in the way that you're thinking of him. You should know better. You didn't make God. You can't make God. That's idolatry. That's what people do. They make a God in their own image and likeness. Oh, I like to think of God like this, they say. And they're making up their own God. That's idolatry. No, you can't make God either out of metal or your thoughts, whether it's a metal image or a mental image. You can't make God. He made you. He's your creator. That's his first point, verse 24. He is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in shrines made by hands. God made you. You can't make God. And then the second point he makes, you notice that in verse 25, he says this, you need him. He doesn't need you. See, that was the huge mistake. That's the big mistake of religion. We think we're doing God a favor by turning up in church on Easter Sunday, don't we? That's idolatry. That's what the Athenians were doing. They're making little shrines and putting them in little temples, and then they would come with their votive offerings. You know, the little plates of food and everything to feed their gods. You shouldn't be thinking of God like that, Paul says. It's supposed to be intelligent people. God doesn't need your votive offerings. He doesn't need you to feed him and to tend him and to look after him. You need him. You can't even draw breath without him. That's what he says, verse 25. He's not served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives everyone life and breath and all things. You can't even draw breath apart from him. He made you, you see. You need him. And the great thing is this, the good news is this, and he wants you. Look at verses 26 and 27. He wants you. From one man he's made every nationality to live over the whole earth and has determined their appointed times and the boundaries of where they live. He did this so that they might seek God and perhaps might reach out to him and find him, though he's not far from any one of us. You see, God is not distant. God is not living through some black hole in some alternative universe. God is not playing hard to get. God does not play hide and seek with us. He's not far from any one of us, Paul says. And he is, not only that, he has arranged, he has so arranged the history and the geography of this world that people from every kind of culture might reach out and find him. He is so, in his sovereignty, he has so ordered the circumstances of your life that you might seek out and find him. That's what Paul is saying. He wants you. He doesn't need you. You need him. And he wants you. Tim Keller's great book, one of Tim Keller's many great books, The Reason for God, ends like this. He tells the story at the end of that book. During a dark time in her life, a woman in my congregation complained that she had prayed over and over again, God, help me find you, but had gotten nowhere. A Christian friend suggested she might change her prayer to, God, come and find me. After all, you're the good shepherd who goes looking for the lost sheep. She concluded, says Keller, when she was recounting this to me, the only reason I can tell you this story is, he did. He did. He did. He is the good shepherd. He does come looking for his lost sheep. That's what the whole gospel's about, isn't it? And so, having analyzed the culture, having stated the negative, if you like, Paul now goes on to the positive. Look what he says, verse 23. What therefore you worship is unknown. In your ignorance. What you worship is unknown. Paul says, this I proclaim to you. See, Paul, this is what Paul is leading up to in this speech before the Areopagus. We've got a summary of his speech in two words, Jesus and the resurrection. And this is what Paul is leading up to in this speech. He wants to tell them about Jesus, because God has made himself known. They don't know who they're worshipping. They don't know God. But God has made himself known in Jesus. That's the point. God, Jesus is God in the flesh. Don't you notice? I don't want to read too much into this, but you notice they must have understood that that's what Paul was saying, because they accuse him of introducing a new deity. Oh, do you want to add another god to the pantheon? We've already got lots of gods, but is Jesus another god? They understood what he was saying about Jesus. It isn't just that Jesus, the historical person, but this Jesus, who is an historical person, is God in the flesh. That's the gospel that we believe, isn't it? That's what people need to understand. It is an amazing thing that in Jesus, God, this God that he's talking about, this God that they don't know and don't recognize, this God has stepped into his own creation. It's like the landlord becoming the lodger. It's like the managing director becoming the office boy. It's like Bono queuing up for a ticket to his own concert. It's like the headmaster getting detention. It's like Picasso learning to paint by numbers. It's like the author writing himself into his own story. In Jesus, that's what God has done. In Jesus, the Creator has stepped into his own creation. In Jesus, God comes to meet us and to embrace us. He is Emmanuel, God with us. He's come looking for us. Now, you may not be looking for him, but I want you to understand this morning, he is looking for you. Do you realize that? I love what John Wesley wrote in his journal. John Wesley was a remarkable man. He was still preaching when he was 85. He traveled 10 times around the globe on horseback, preaching the gospel. Did you know that? 250,000 miles on horseback. He preached 40,000 sermons. And he sums it all up like this. In one entry in his diary, he says, "I came to town and I offered them Christ." That's it. That was John Wesley's life's calling. I came to town, and town after town after town, both in the UK and in America, town after town after town, I came to town, says John Wesley, and I offered them Christ. That's what Paul did in Athens. Didn't come to bring them an argument, he came to offer them Christ. Him I proclaim to you. So Jesus reveals the unknown God to us. That's how we come to know God, it's through Jesus. Jesus is God with flesh, God with skin on his face. That's who Jesus is. And not only does Jesus reveal God to us, but he reveals the very heart of God to us. Look, Jesus went to the cross. Why did Jesus go to the cross? Because, well, it's the same word, you see. It's the same word that's used to describe the reason why Paul's motivation for speaking to the Athenians. It's the word in the Old Testament, in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, is this word which describes, well, it's jealousy. It's a jealous love. God is jealous. He's not jealous of us. He's jealous for us. I might be jealous of Doug O'Donnell because he's a better preacher than me. I'm not saying that he is, and I'm not saying that I am jealous of him, but I'm just using this as an illustration. That would be wrong. That would be sinful for me to be jealous of another preacher. But if there was another man trying to contact my wife and go out with my wife, I would be right, wouldn't I, to be jealous? There's jealousy and jealousy. God isn't jealous of all these 30,000 gods in Athens. They're non-entities. God isn't jealous of idols. He's jealous for the people who are being blinded and brought into captivity by this idolatry. He's jealous for the people that he has made in his own image and likeness. His heart is breaking because of the idolatry that he sees in your life and in my life. He doesn't want you worshipping false gods. He wants you in his arms, not in the arms of another. Do you see? He's not a dispassionate, disinterested God, distant and detached. He wants you for himself, and he will not tolerate any rivals. See, idolatry, what is idolatry? It's replacing God in your affections with someone or something else. And that provokes God to jealousy, and that's what brought Jesus to the cross, and that's what brought Paul to Athens. And this one who came to reveal God to us, this one who came and died on a cross so that we might be reconciled to God, is coming back. That's what it says, doesn't it? Verses 30 and 31. He's coming back again to wind up history and to judge the world. Verse 30, having overlooked the times of ignorance. Isn't that interesting? People go to Oxford and Cambridge to study the classics. See how Paul describes the golden age of Greek and Roman philosophy? He says, times of ignorance. Oh, I've studied Latin. God winks at it. God winks at such times of ignorance. But now he commands everyone everywhere to repent. Do you see what it says? Because he's set a day when he's going to judge the world in righteousness by this very man whom he has appointed. He's provided proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. What a reversal. See, they've hauled Paul before the council so that they could judge Jesus. What's this strange new idea you've brought into town? They're going to decide, you see, whether or not to put Jesus in the pantheon, whether or not they should add him to the 30,000 other gods in Athens. But you see what Paul says to them? He says, it's not for you to judge Jesus. Jesus is going to judge you. Have you understood that, my friends? That really is the message of the resurrection. That's why it is such a dangerous idea. Look what it says there in verse 32. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some sneered, others said, tell us more. Like the Q&A audience, they didn't know whether to clap or to jeer, but some believed, it says. You see, you can't remain neutral to the resurrection. You have to decide, did it happen? You have to decide, is it a hoax or is it a fact? But you can't remain neutral. It's bomb in the building sort of stuff, isn't it? Imagine you're in the airport. Sorry to use this sort of illustration in these times in which we live, but I think it's a useful illustration. Imagine you're at the airport waiting for your plane, and an announcement comes over the tannoy that there is a bomb in the building. You can't ignore that, can you? If an official announcement comes over the tannoy that there is a bomb in the building, you have to decide, is that a hoax or is that for real? You can't stay there. You have to make up your mind. If it was me, I'd be out of there as fast as my legs would carry me. And the resurrection of Jesus is that kind of information. Because in the resurrection of Jesus, God has vindicated his Son. And he has served us notice that he is going to judge the world in righteousness by this man whom he has appointed. And the gospel is not inviting you to judge Jesus. It is informing you that Jesus is going to judge you. And if that is true, and if the tomb is empty, as proof that that is true, you can't just sit there and say, oh, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that aspect of it before. It's an interesting insight. No, no, my friends, if this is true, if Jesus is the one who's going to judge the world and God has served notice by raising him from the dead, then you'd better run as fast as your legs can take you to Jesus as your Savior and your Lord. So how do you present the gospel to a pagan society like ours? Well, you tell them about Jesus and the resurrection. Paul says in Romans chapter 1 and verse 4 that Jesus was declared with power to be the Son of God by his resurrection from the dead. And you have to decide whether that's a fact or a hoax, but you can't ignore it, can you? And you must act upon it, because your eternal destiny depends on how you respond to the resurrection of Jesus. So where do you fit in on this Easter Sunday? Are you an Epicurean, living for pleasure? Or a Stoic, just doing your duty? Or an Athenian, more interested in what's new than in what's true? Or do you want to consider this further? If so, I would be more than happy to meet up with you and talk with you about this, if you want to consider this further. Or maybe you're already persuaded, like this man Dionysius, who according to the history, early church history, became the first pastor of the church in Athens. He was a member of the Areopagus. Maybe, like Dionysius, you want to decide this morning to become a follower of the resurrected Christ.